Powell, reel number 7. What kind of aircraft were you operating with the training squadron?
We had Avros powered by 80 horsepower Gnome engines. And that leads me immediately to the advancement when we at last had to convert our Avros from the 80 Gnome to the 100 horsepower monosuperb. Now, the difference between those two engines was that whilst the Gnome was fed from a tank by gravity, the monosuperb had to be fed by a pressure tank. And at this time, there was a shortage of supplies, and although we were ordered to convert gnomes to monos, we could not get delivery of the conversion sets, that is, the pressure tanks. We were told, notwithstanding that, go right ahead and put the mono into the aeroplane. Well, one squadron, commanded by a Major Mealing, immediately obeyed this order and put his pumps, air pump, onto his gravity tanks with the obvious result that all the rivets sprang and his squadron was very soon completely out of action with no serviceable aircraft. I wouldn't move until I got the conversion sets because I was a monosuperb pilot and had been for over a year and I knew what was entailed. I then received a letter from the group headquarters which was headed, or rather meant to head, reconversion of Gnome Avros to monos. Will you please explain why you refused to carry out this order? Well, that was rather a staggering thing to answer, but I was saved by the fact that the typist had made an error, and instead of writing reconversion of Gnome Avros to monos, it was headed reconversation of Gnome Avros to monos. I promptly wrote back, heading the same, my letter, reconversation of Gnome Avros to monos. Up to the moment, I have overheard no conversation between Gnome Avros and monos, but should this occur, I shall immediately inform the group. Some 2 days afterwards, my wing commander rang up, and he said, I've been instructed to give you a bit of a reprimand. And I said, what for, sir? And he said, for treating official correspondence with flippancy. And I said, well, actually, I answered the letter as it was sent. I wasn't even rude about it, but I did give the answer. And the wing commander said, well, just between ourselves, I think it was a damn good answer.
Now, during this period at Turn Hill, when you were involved with training new recruits, were there any changes in the flying training procedures, say, as compared with your own training earlier in the war?
No, when I was learning to fly at the beginning of 1915, I can't say that through the whole of my experience in the war, the actual dual control procedure had altered at all. The pupil was in the aircraft with the instructor, and he was gradually allowed to take control. He was taught how to bank, how to turn, how to come in and land and try to make a three-point landing. And it was just a question of practice, practice, practice. And eventually the pupil would be sent off by himself, his first solo. He passed that and he would do, say, 4 or 5 hours solo, and eventually he'd be granted his wings. By then he is a fully qualified pilot. And incidentally, talking about the Avro, I think that was one of the most marvellous pieces of aeronautical engineering that was ever achieved, because Mr. A.V. Rowe designed and built the Avro in 1912. And when one realises that that Avro, practically unaltered except for the change of engines as the time went by, it was exactly the same, and it was used as a Royal Flying Corps instruction machine right into the 1930s. That is a terrific time for any aircraft to have lasted during a period when the advancement of flying and all the new types of aircraft were being introduced.
Why do you think it was so good as a training machine?
It was very, very easy to handle, except for the fact that it had a balanced rudder, which caused the pupil a terrific amount of difficulty, because he felt no pressure on the rudder bar when he put the rudder on. There was no feeling at all, and the best way, the way I used to instruct a pupil, was to dig his heels hard onto the floor with his toes against the rudder bar and slide the whole heel across the floor, not to put his instep on the rudder bar, because he'd never be able to control it. It would swing quickly from one side to the other, merely because he had no feel at all. That was the disadvantage. And really, I cannot see, except for a very big, heavy machine, that balance controls were necessary at all. I think they were a handicap rather than a help. During this period, there was one new development, in that one of the courses we had to put the pupils through was formation flying. And that was a thing which was not very popular, and I'm afraid it was one that I frequently forgot. And in order to make sure I didn't forget, I used to have a special treat for the pupils who had done well, and I would take four of those and take them off on a formation flight. I took them to Southport for the day, and then again from Turnhill to Blackpool, where I landed on the sands. We had a day at Blackpool, and we came back. All this was in tight formation, and we came back in the evening in what we thought was a tight formation. Nothing like today, of course, with the red arrows, but it wasn't too bad.
Did you have any Commonwealth or Allied trainee pilots going through your hands at Turnhill?
In one instance, I had an American who came over, and he flew very well and eventually was awarded his wings. And then one day, his flying instructor came in and said that he refused to fly. He said he was tired of flying and he wanted a rest, and his nerve had gone, and therefore he refused an order to go round and do his normal circuits and bumps. And I said to the instructor, I said, well, when he refused, what did you do? And he said, I told him that I'd report him to the CO. And this officer said, I'm a free-born American citizen, and I came over here to do my bit, but unfortunately my nerve's gone. And it immediately struck me that what he was aiming for was to come over here, and as America was not then in the war, and learned to fly, and then to be sent back to America, where he'd pick up a fat job as a pilot and as an instructor at the expense of this country. That naturally made me insist that I would get him out to France somehow, even if not a pilot. So I sent for him, and I said, I suppose you came over here really to do your bit and to fight in the war? He said, oh, yes, sir. And I said, well, unfortunately, now you've lost your nerve. The only thing for me to do would be to kick you out, which would be rather a stigma. You'd be sent back to America. And I think that obviously you've got your heart in the right place. And so instead of putting the risk of another pilot, another officer's life in your hands when you've lost your nerve, what about going out as an observer? I think, really, you ought to transfer and go out as an observer, because I doubt very much, I said, if I can arrange that, but it's worth a try. And he then said, well, yes, I came over to do my bit, and I'd be only too pleased. I put him through to lose his wings and to go as an observer, and to my intense delight, it was approved. And the last I saw of this gentleman was when he went out to France as an observer. Now, after some 4 months as OC 43 training squadron, you must realize that at that time I was a young fellow, just 21 years old, and the responsibility and the irksome duties of a squadron commander in charge of a training squadron meant a terrific amount of paperwork, and it wasn't my idea of going into the war. I didn't like this at all. I hated the idea from changing from an active pilot down to a sort of glorified telephone orderly and clerk. And so I put in an application to be sent overseas. I realized at the time that as squadrons overseas wished to promote their own officers in their own units, that there would be very little chance of me getting out in the rank as a squadron commander or even a flight commander. So I applied to go out as a flying officer. The wing commander, on receiving my application, said, "I can't do this, Pearl. That would be demotion. You'd have to be court-martialed before I could send you out like that." And I said, "Well, would you try, sir, because I have no ambition in this war or in the service beyond getting out to France again." And he said, "Well, all right, I'll put it through." I then received a wire which said I was posted overseas as DH-5 pilot. I'd never flown a DH-5, but as a DH-5 pilot. Now, the DH-5, I think that the designers at that time realized that the average tractor aircraft did obstruct the vision for the pilot. And so whoever designed the DH-5, which of course was de Havilland, they had made a machine with the top plane, they were all biplanes, of course, which was staggered back. It had a backward stagger so that one could look up and had a very fair field of vision. But the trouble was, it was a most unsatisfactory aircraft. It was a terrible thing if one tried to do any aerobatics at all. Two people in a DH-5 squadron in France had already tried to loop. The result was that in both instances the wings came off, and that, of course, in those days of no parachutes, was fatal. But after the I'd been there, I went as a DH-5 pilot. I went to the squadron, and to my amazement I was there to command, which meant that I was promoted, incidentally, above the heads of quite a number of people anxious to get out, who had been then in home establishment longer than they wanted to be.
What were your experiences with the DH-5 when you first tried it out in France?
Well, rather horrific, because the morning after I'd arrived at the squadron, I went into, took off in a DH-5, to see what they were like. I'd never having flown one before. I took it up to about 3,000 feet and started to do a loop. I put the nose down till I was doing about 100 miles an hour, and I pulled up in a loop. When I got upside down on the loop, it appeared as though a large hand had come out from heaven, grabbed the aircraft and rattled it and shook it. It was the most terrifying thing. And as I fell out of the bottom of that loop, I thought, well, probably I wasn't going fast enough. So I reclimbed to 3,000 feet, and I pushed my nose down till I was doing about 120. I then came up into a loop. And that was even worse, because the big hand rattled the machine even so badly I was almost bruised, and incidentally terribly frightened. I fell out of that, and I'd had enough. I came in and landed. I didn't realize, but I heard afterwards, that while I was doing this evolution, the flight commander standing on the tarmac called and said, "Come on quickly and look at the new CO. He's stunting a DH-5. I couldn't tell them that I wasn't trying to stunt a DH-5. I was terrified.
Now, quite soon after you arrived in France, 41 Squadron was in fact re-equipped with SE-5s. Can you tell me a bit about these aircraft?
Yes, the SE-5 was a beautiful little aeroplane, and it was armed with two machine guns, a Lewis on the top plane, and a Vickers in the nacelle with a Constantinesco gear, which allowed the gun to fire through the propeller straight ahead. And quite an advance compared to any machine that I'd ever flown before. It was a beautiful machine to fly, very easily handled, and reminded more than anything of the dear old Airfro. It was a simple machine, but delightful. It had one snag. The power was a 200-horsepower Hispano-Suiza engine. And the difficulty was that the mechanics from Hispano-Suiza, who spoke nothing but French, no English, had to instruct my own technical sergeant major and the technical mechanics in the working of the Hispano. The difficulty between the language, as one can imagine, was almost insuperable. But they managed.